This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rastlan, today in this momentous times in Malaysian political history, we have the return of, she's ex-BFM, and she's now, she describes herself as a middle-aged fangirl.
Oh, my goodness. Hello.
Well, that was your description.
Hi, Azura.
Well, and that will become clearer later.
Okay.
Azura Rahman.
Hello, hello.
And we have back here after far too long.
Yes.
But also perhaps for the last time.
Ooh.
Because he's leaving BFM.
That's right.
And this very show is his last utterance on,
on
BFM as a full-time employee.
That's right.
He is Ezra Zayed.
Hello, hello.
Who has been recently the head of video.
And digital.
Digital.
And all that.
And all that. And he's now going to be, what are you going to do?
I'm not sure. I think I'm going to try to take some time out. But yeah, that's as far as I got.
Okay, great. And that's as far as we're
going
to go.
He's going to be me 2 years ago, basically.
Yeah. So our three topics this week are, topic number one, in light of recent political thingamajigs, the able administrator versus patronage. Topic number two is middle-aged fangirl. And finally, topic number three is ghosting.
Wow. We've figured the show now.
Ghosting, yeah. Ghosting, but not goodbyes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. We'll ghosting, get there.
Right. So, unless you're a Malaysian who's been living under a rock, you may have noticed this last week has been tumultuous. And I'm not going to address the political ins and outs per se, but I have been interested in the imagery that I've been witnessing of the various politicians, the way they carry themselves, the way they have been carrying themselves over the last few years, last few decades, in fact. And I would say that there are two strands in Malaysian political life. One is what I'm going to call the able administrator,
mm-hmm.
and the other is patronage or client-patron relationships. And I would also say that the fact that this country came into being, really, before independence, under administration by the British, the British Empire, I think has left many legacies, and one of which is the idea of the able administrator. The British really prided themselves on the idea that wherever they went in the world, the phrase keeps turning up when I read contemporary accounts. They described themselves as able administrators because that was their USP, and they were essentially ruling over people who were less advanced.
They felt that their systems and their methodology was something that could be encapsulated by many people across different parts of the world.
Well, they could do it.
Yeah,
and they would often say, "Oh, you know, we would really like for these brown people to take over one day, but they're just not ready now."
This sounds a little bit racist, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole thing was based on...
See, this colonialism thing is what I hear.
You know what? It's 2020 and we still have this colonial hangover.
For sure.
Do you know what I mean?
No, but what I want to just focus on, though, is the image that was portrayed in that time. That they portrayed the image of themselves as being incorruptible and brilliant administrators. And I know that my father's generation, my father himself was not so keen on them, but many of his contemporaries, when they entered the civil service in Malaysia, they wanted to carry on in that mold. That was the way they were trained. Another image that I think we've been seeing quite a lot is patronage, client-patron relationship, which is, you could describe it as, you know, you scratch my back, I'll take care of you. You build up relationships and you can kowtow, you can bend over backwards, but you know that you'll be taken care of. And you show allegiance to somebody. But everybody understands that allegiance isn't necessarily forever.
Mm.
As long as the river of patronage flows to you continuously.
It's feudalism in that sense, isn't it?
Yeah, and those two, right? I mean, that sort of local brewed feudalism meeting with, I guess, almost like an imported version of how to go about doing things. And I think it's always been contesting since, I guess, from the time that you described, even till now. And
yeah.
We can see it even in the old texts about how we sort of navigate. I remember reading excerpts of Hikayat Munshi Abdullah, just always sort of trying to reconcile what he observed of his local contemporaries with this quote-unquote foreign influence. And it's been a struggle. And I think, as you said, in the past few days, we're seeing that emerge again and again. It's just part of our fabric right now.
But I think also people respond, whoever you are, you respond to the image that, that is portrayed positively or negatively. I do think that patronage, and I'm not knocking patronage actually, it has actually served a purpose for hundreds, perhaps thousands of years. The problem for patronage is as societies, populations get larger, as economies become more complex, it isn't necessarily able to cope. And people turn, especially urban people, people whose families have been urban for generations, turn to the idea of, oh, we need able administrators. And I'd say that a lot of government ministers have been portraying that image. But the problem with that image is it doesn't have a story. There's no personality to it. And people often want to see a personality, somebody that I can connect with.
Are we talking about seeing a better version of themselves in these able administrators?
Not necessarily a better version of themselves, but suddenly somebody, oh, I'm in safe hands.
Yeah, we do like that.
Do like that. Yeah. So I think that there's this sort of schizophrenia in Malaysian society. On the one hand, oh, yes, we want the able administrator. And as we speak, don't know what's going to happen.
We don't have an able administrator.
Well, we kind of do. I mean, the idea that Mahathir Mohamad is able to, there's an image of him at his desk, just another day at work. The idea that a person just, he works, and then it was noted that he left the office at 5:45.
Yeah.
And people go, ah. Oh. People, he's a brilliant politician. He knows imagery.
Yeah.
He knows how to sell it.
But at the same time, you have the Agong now, who's suddenly been propelled to the forefront of politics. And people also seek comfort in that, that we have this backstop in case, you know, the people that we have so, well, elected fail. We have this backstop of this generous monarch who still has the concerns of his vassals at hand, you know? And I think that's a lot of comfort for a lot of people, even in a way that they did not expect themselves to be. Suddenly there's, you know, there's so much love for this monarch that's been born into his role, that hasn't been chosen by the rakyat, so to speak.
The strange thing about that particular juxtaposition of the prime minister, you know, as part of this almost Westminster system, and then there's the Agong, who is trying his best to respect the constitution and play his part, and you're trying to put them together. And when you see them two together, a citizen, you're going, gosh, I hope that's enough. Gosh, I hope that's enough that will get us across the next bridge that will hopefully bring us to safe haven. Because, you know, we're so dependent on these figures and structures. We've almost forgotten about how a minority government is supposed to work, a unity government. We're not reliant on sort of the rules and structures of the old able administrator. We're going with the feel and gut now, almost.
Yeah.
But that's the thing, you know, that's a very interesting response where you're thinking, oh my gosh, this is going to be enough. But at which point does the rakyat say, look, you know, let's stop all of this, let's take the power back to our hands? You know, what's a very interesting observation for me is that any other country out there who's undergoing the kind of turmoil that we're going through at the moment, there'll be people on the streets, literally. And, making memes. You know, we are making light of it. You know, yes, we're having Milo trucks by the palace. And that's how Malaysians respond, which is,
well, that's how,
you can
that's
see
KL,
comfort in
but
that.
But that's how KL Malaysians are responding. We've seen those images. We don't know what other people are, how other people are responding to it. I would suggest that there are a lot of people out there who want to see our leaders taking charge. We don't want to take the streets.
Why don't we?
No, what I'm saying is that, you know, you can say that because you're an urbanite.
Azura's
kind of
ready,
thing.
Clearly.
Yeah. I've got my banners in my boot, right? Ready to go, right?
Yeah, but what if you're embedded in a patronage system and you have your patron and you want to know what your patron's going to do because you rely upon your patron for your income?
Which makes me think that we are really at a juncture where we as Malaysians need to think, what do we want? Separate from these two different systems that you mentioned. You know, this is the point where we have to think, you know, okay, well, there might be a third way. And, you know, we are in charge. We really are. We should be in charge.
I agree with the fact that we should be in charge. But for me, just observing the lack of the number of people who want to see this resolved through the polls, there is a reservation, or there is a, do we just want to go back to the polls again? Because we can't determine the outcome. Right?
Yeah.
We want to sort of curate the outcome.
Yes. So we want democracy just
because. But then we fear what's going to happen to Bursa, you know, if we have a snap election,
of course. Well, I would just finish with just saying that I do think that the people who have been portraying themselves as the able administrators have perhaps let themselves down by not also inhabiting a story, because people want to see stories. Well, that sounds very vague, but you know, patronage has stories. You walk up to a person, if you know the patronage system, I know the game we're going to play. It's going to be a wayang, and it's going to be, you know, you want to have that kind of game to be played as well. So anyway, we're going to move on to something now completely different.
Yeah.
Azura.
Bring a bit of light and cheer to the studio.
Azura.
The ray of sunshine that you are.
Middle-aged fangirl.
Yeah, I mean, I hear a lot of
I've been waiting all day for this.
I hear a lot of judgment in your tones.
No,
and
nada,
voices,
nada,
okay?
Nada.
But, you know, I'll sail through this somehow. I'm talking about the particularly modern-day phenomenon of fangirling when you're middle-aged. Because when you think of fangirls, you think of young teeny boppers screaming their heads off, going, ah. But, you know, that has changed. You know, we're in 2020, 40 is a new 20, whatever it is. And particularly in the K-pop sphere, there is a rise and inclusivity of fans who are 30 years old and beyond. Mm. And, you know, so you have these women in particular who are seen obsessing, showing their appreciation for, you know, idols who are on the average the age of 19. And it's okay.
Somebody's done the math.
Okay. So that's the end of that topic. We move on. It's okay.
So why do you say it's okay? I mean, because obviously, you know, as a reference point to this, my 17-year-old cousin, Faliha, she, big fan. She went to visit Seoul recently. And, you know, the updates of every bibimbap or every particular character or every particular location, it was shared with the family with such great joy because she was finally in her Hollywood. And she really, really enjoyed it. But are you saying that it's somewhat acceptable for the tweens to get away with that and not so much for another group of
I mean, look at how you guys are reacting to this whole topic. No, the thing is, okay, you see, the typical characteristics of any K-pop fangirl, normally, you know, there's a sense of community. So you're saying about the sharing of information. They move in hives, you know? And every big K-pop act has, you know, their particular hive, whether it's the ARMY for BTS or you've got, like, Blinks for Blackpink. You know, stop laughing, Ezra Zayed.
They're great terms.
You're going to be flamed for this, I tell you. And another thing is that they tend to have a high disposable income. You're talking about your cousin who flew all the way to Seoul.
Yeah,
and that is you know, you got to have a lot of money because you have girls who buy not 300 CDs but 1,000 CDs to just get a ticket to go for a K-pop fan meet. Fan meets cost you.
I'm astonished at people buying CDs.
Yeah, you know, if you want to get the golden ticket, to go and see your fan.
Oh, it's in one of those.
Yeah.
But I'm also just impressed, you know, the number of times I've gone to KLIA and you see a swarm of people sort of waiting by the VIP section.
Yeah.
And without
I've not been there.
Assuming and addressing. You just ask one of the kids who are there, is it, what's happening? Oh, I'm the K-pop star. Da, da, da. And it's a huge amount of people. I mean, I just love the notion that we're on that level of being that excited about celebrity, let alone
but,
K-pop.
But Azura, let's just lay cards on the table. So therefore, you are a fan of K-pop.
I'm not.
Oh, so we're talking in the abstract.
I'm not a K-pop fangirl. I'm a K-drama fangirl. I have my oppas, yeah.
Okay.
But, you know, the thing
she likes this show called Reply 1988. It's got a lot of 80s, 90s nostalgia. And, of course, you know, the Korean culture is so interchangeable with the Malaysian experience.
You know.
You know, so, I mean, I watched one episode. So, and I get it.
There's that sense of melodrama. There's that sense of family. There's that sense of...
people not saying things.
Yes!
I don't know.
I mean, they say things, but there's a subtext to it, which is something that we engage in a lot, clearly, from what we're seeing the past few days.
There's even an inflection in how they speak that's similar to how, you know, the Malays speak. It's very melodic in that sense.
Yeah.
And I mean, I'm not a huge K-pop fan, but you know, going to research, you know, I have my friends who are K-pop fangirls in their middle age.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of peculiarities in K-pop that I found very unusual. I mean, for example, you know, all of their stars are super, super polite in the sense that they apologize for stepping on someone's toe, literally. You've had idols apologizing because he had smoked in front of a fan and a fan spotted him and flamed him for it. You have idols like Chen from EXO, huge band, apologizing for getting engaged and wanting to marry the love of his life. And the reason why he has to do that is because, as it is, there's been a reaction for him to be kicked out of the group. And, you know, there's anti-fans who's, you know, gathering money to shame him in his hometown with an advert on a bus. It's crazy. I mean, it's
so is it
you
the
are
soap
really
opera that you're enjoying?
Sorry?
Is it the soap opera that you're enjoying?
Or are you enjoying the role of the fans in almost this sort of like...
They've got power, haven't they?
They have
do.
Real power. That's
they
what
do.
I mean. Yeah.
They do.
They're kind of like wrestling fans. Because even if you're a bad guy or a good guy as a wrestler, whatever character you've made, the fans decide which way you go, whether you're a heel or whether you're a good guy.
I'll give an example, not so much for K-pop itself, but for K-dramas, for example. They normally have about 16 to 20 episodes for every series, right? And you always find that by the 14th episode or the 16th episode, it kind of goes slightly off tangent. And you're thinking, why is it suddenly going that way? Then you realize it's because the writers are actually responding to the feedback in the forums. They do live filming. So basically, you know, they film as they go along.
Right.
And hence, you know, storylines can change on the basis of the popularity of a character.
Very democratic.
And then it might be frustrating for you as a viewer.
Or right? a writer.
And then when you see like an OTP, which means one true pairing, does not go the way you want it to go. Oh. You know, so
have you written in?
I've not.
Are you
I mean,
oh my God.
To? Of course not. I do not watch any K-drama live.
This is really the next phase of your creativity, just, you know, shifting and moving the narrative to your whims.
I can still hear the sarcasm in your voice.
Well, not from me, you
not
can't.
From
so,
me,
you can't. Azura, you have kids. Are they into K-pop and stuff?
Actually, you know, it was my son
or is it
and
mommy's
my
thing?
No, it's not mommy's thing. Mommy is supportive of his son loving BTS and Inaya loving Blackpink.
Right.
But you know, I used to be like you. Right? Very
what?
Disdainful.
I am not disdainful.
Okay. to anyone who's
shots
listening.
Shots fired, you know? Elizabeth Warren.
But it's just a very different way of how what I've been exposed to in terms of entertainment operates. You know, Hollywood operates in a very different way.
Very different. Yeah.
You know, to how the K world does. You know, it really puts you up on a pedestal, but you have to behave the way I want you to behave.
Mm. But which is actually in light of, I think, maybe Parasite winning Best Picture, that had a different kind of
vibe
about it. But you feel that it was part of the culmination of this 10, 15, 20 year project, right? That resulted in that moment.
So I'm a big fan of Korean movies, not K-drama. Because I just, that they are from such different universes.
Yeah.
It's crazy that they're different.
You know, how I see it is, you know, I saw a list of all the 10 Korean movies you got to watch post-Parasite, right? And what really struck me is this really came from an American ethnocentric lens, right? You know, this is what I think K-movies should be about. But it's not necessarily what the Koreans like.
No,
might not necessarily reflect
on
what they like from a day-to-day basis. K-drama is it.
No, I'm sure. I mean, I've really immersed myself in the movies, though, and I've begun to see different tropes and repetitions.
There are a lot of tropes in K-dramas.
No,
well,
I'm sure. Maybe I'll check them out. But on anthropological...
Reply 1988. That's the one you need to watch. Ezra's only watched one episode, you know, the treacherous friend that he is.
Well,
but I think I have more
really
faith in you.
Because he really doxed you. Like, did I say that right? Doxing?
Yes, sure. Sure.
Right.
We'll Google that later.
Well, you be proud, sister. You, all right.
You middle-aged man girl.
Nuna, that's what you call me. Not Anjuma, okay? Anjuma's too old.
Okay.
Oh my
There's
goodness.
Some the fans who are just really loving those references on our behalf.
Joseph Hamnida, if I say anything wrong, okay? Do not flame me, please.
Sempat lagi kalau tersalah cakap, kalau terkasar bahasa.
Okay. And in a moment, we're going to come to topic number three, where we're going to be even more well-behaved. Because we're going to get feedback and they'll be telling us. And we're going to hear about Ezra Zide's not leaving but ghosting here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Azura Rahman, and Ezra Zide. So, Ezra, this is your last ever performance, certainly as a full-time employee.
His last gasp.
Last gasp on BFM.
The trailer is looking great
right
now.
And you want to tell us about how you're not going to say goodbye, but you're going
to
ghost.
Well, no, I mean, you know, in deciding to move on from BFM, it's been a lovely long relationship of about just shy of 9 years. I've always generally found goodbyes terribly tough to pull off, you know, whether it be with friends, or even finishing boarding school, or even finishing a project. You just want to keep going and not sort of send it off. And I guess in looking for a relevant article to bring this all together, there's of course the concept of ghosting. And actually, in my conversation with some of my friends, they're a bit more definitive about how they want to do their goodbyes. Whereas I'm a little bit more let's see where we're going, let's see where the mood is, and I almost stretch it along. And I'm just curious whether you guys are any better at goodbyes than I am.
Well, so but you just be clear though, you decided you wanted to be on A Bit of Culture.
Yes.
To say out loud.
Bye bye, adios.
Bye bye,
adieu.
But you're such a shy person that you're
not really ghosting us, Joe. You're actually saying goodbye proper now.
Well, but it's a very long, drawn out. Whereas ghosting is meant to sort of, you almost disappear,
yeah.
Right? Sure. You disappear into the night like Batman almost.
Of course, the classic one that I'm sure you would get would be Eric Cantona's departure from Manchester United.
So he's at the top of his game and he sort of disappears without a moment's notice. I mean, it's that I could not do.
He never said goodbye. He never did. I mean, like years later, he sort of like.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a French goodbye, isn't it?
Yeah, well, yeah. So you're denying, I mean, he was denying closure for the fans.
Yes.
Which was very selfish, which was very selfish.
Right. but I mean, and so that approach I could not pull off.
Because you're not Cantona.
Apart from many other reasons, I just have the jersey.
Sorry.
Are you any good?
I think I am. I mean, I need to have clear lines, you know, in the sense of, you know, when I say goodbye to BFM, you make me do it live, Ezra Zayed, on the Evening Edition. And
but in my head, see, that's me putting almost closure of an era. So that's, I mean, almost with the goodbyes, I almost like produce them almost because I'm a producer at heart. And I...
Not for long enough. Okay. but unemployed producer.
Well, yeah. Another 10 minutes maybe. Yeah.
And you can produce them as best as you can until...
Just be producing on the street.
Yeah, I know. Like, unemployed, what's going
he's
on?
He's on independent podcast.
Yeah. Oh, calm down,
I've
folks.
I've got a podcast. I've got a podcast.
You know, I have a fear of goodbyes because, you know, actually on this show, whenever Azura's on, it always gets very deeply personal, so I'm going to do it this time. She didn't. My father died when I was very young, and it was extremely sudden.
How old were you?
I was 4 years old. And he and my mother went off for a drive, and he never came back because he died whilst driving. So I've grown up with a fear of endings.
Yes, yes.
Some books, which I've really enjoyed, I've actually kind of refused to finish.
Right.
Because is it because you know how they're going to land on an ending?
Yeah. And
or it's so good that you don't want to... You don't want it to end.
Not that. No, it's the landing on the ending. I know where it's going to go, and I don't want that era, that time to finish.
That's tough, yeah.
And so I am a ghoster, as it were, more.
Right, but could you pull it off? Could you pull off the act of ghosting?
Could you just not turn up next week, you know, at least, you know, asking you to come? Oh, where's your next interview?
Do a Cantona.
Yeah.
No, I don't think you could.
Well, I mean, if I were in the mood, I'm not, Producer Ali. Don't. you're auditioning, aren't you? But no, I think also the pulling off ghosting, you've no idea if you pulled it off or not. I mean, the people you've left behind, they're all like, you know, Ezra who? I've no idea.
Don't you think it's cowardly, though, ghosting?
Yes, yes. I mean, at the
it's
very
easy
least.
Easy for you, but it's hard for everyone else.
Yeah, yeah. And of course, you know, in doing this long goodbye for the past 3 months, I've sort of landed in a really relatively good positive space. I'm very, very happy with where I am, with where the company is, and just looking forward to like a future relationship with the space of people, right?
Did you have a list of things you wanted to do in those 3 months? Okay, I got to make sure this is taken care of, this is taken care of, blah, 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 blah. Or was it just you just kind of going through the motions?
I think the only priority I had was for like, oh, this is going to sound. But it was really for sort of the younger generation of staff because...
Smooth transition.
A smooth transition, but also just to be excited about doing what you can do. I think sometimes like you go through the day to day without sort of being excited anymore about what you can possibly get away with. In the past 9 years, I've gotten away with all sorts of things in this organization. It's allowed me to express myself creatively. It's been a great playground. It's been, wonderful collaborations with so many different people. But if you think that that's just something that happens, I'm sorry, you're not. You got to work at it. You got to nurture it. You got to make things happen. So I think that was something that was important, just to make sure that there's a reminder that whatever idea, whatever cool thing you want to pursue, it's worth going to bat for it.
So you've led the young ones through the desert.
Yes, sure.
And now they have to see the old man fall by the wayside.
Well, that's one way to look at it. But also, just on my own terms, I'm extremely competitive in wanting to prove that I've got a couple of gears left in my own sort of sphere, and that in this next chapter just involves a re-examination of what that.
It's the solo album, isn't it?
Yeah. Can I ask you? Highlight of the past 9 years.
Highlights?
Yeah.
Just
highlights enough as well.
Well, I mean, it's the comforting thing about people leaving and saying their goodbyes, but then actually coming back for a couple of hellos.
Looking at me.
Present, and I think that's very much part of the feeling and the culture of what this place represents. So I think if the place didn't have it, it wouldn't have attracted this kind of mood or energy. And I think you've seen it time and time again. You know, it's hard to say goodbye to a place that you like and that you've gotten a lot of joy out of.
Yeah.
The door's never closed, though.
Yes.
No.
Surely,
yeah. No. But actually, I had an experience once where I was working at a place, and
shall
I remain nameless.
Sounds like
also because I've forgotten the name. I've worked in many places. I'm a freelancer, and I left there, and I was like, "You're all useless. I hate you, and you're rubbish." And I left, and then a short while later, I thought, "I've made a terrible mistake." And then it is really hard. I can tell you now, it's really hard to go back, knock on the door, and say. All that other stuff, you know?
it's funny. I mean, that's a Larry David skit from his time at SNL that he sort of yells off at everyone and he makes it into Seinfeld. But essentially, he comes back to Monday and just pretends it never happened. And that's a George Costanza reference. On
Seinfeld. That'd be great if you could do that as right? Well. Just turn up on Monday.
Yeah, just going,
hey, guys.
Well, hey, guys. are those quotations signed yet? I mean, what do you guys want to do?
Okay, so before we say... Our goodbyes on this show. Just to say, we're going to play out with a piece of music that you've chosen, so that people can have an even longer goodbye.
Yes,
because the piece of music is going to be
"American Pie" by Don McLean,
which is about 3 hours long.
That's right. I told you I'm bad at this.
Well, Ezra, I don't know what to say. I mean, it's obviously, see you again.
Yeah.
But it'll be in a more diminished kind of like Ezra, wouldn't it? It's like...
Go easy there.
Is it a diminished Ezra you're talking about?
So close, Cam. We were so close to the end of the segment without
all those
that.
Korean fans. You were so rude. What are we going to do? I don't know.
But folks, it's been a real pleasure, sitting opposite both of you, as well as our producer, Ali Johan, who's always manning the decks.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah.
It's an honor, Ezra.
It's been great.
Wow, yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you very much.
So anyway, enough of him. And we move on, though. Actually, there's a final part of the show still to do, which is recommendations, where I recommend something that we think might be of interest. And I'm going to go first. My recommendation is, it's very simple, is in light of the political stuff that's been going on, is if you haven't already got one, buy yourself a battery pack. Because I have drained the battery and recharge it off battery packs like 5 times a day. And if I didn't have, I don't know how I would cope with this situation without social media in the old fashioned way, you know, just like, oh, when's the news on TV3? And what's it say in the NST?
And all right, 90s cameras.
No, but you know what I mean?
Exactly.
I
get a telex on.
This drama is being played out in real time.
Yeah.
Of course, there are a lot of lies and mistakes being
made. A lot of distortions of truth here. Yeah.
But if I didn't have my mobile phone and power in it, I don't know how I would cope.
So get some juice, get some power.
Yeah, yeah. So, Azura, what's yours?
Okay, in the light of Parasite winning Best Picture at the Oscars and also my topic for the day.
So much glee.
My recommendation is a recipe. Now, if you've watched a movie, you remember the scene where they came back from camping.
Spoiler, I haven't watched it yet. Anyway, sorry,
but it's not really...
Small plot point.
Not much of a spoiler. But basically, she gets the housekeeper to prepare herself, to prepare for the family a ramen dish. The subtitle says Ramdon, but it's also known in Korean as Chagapuri or Chapaguri. Sorry, I got it wrong.
But from what I understand, it's the combination of two fast food noodles, right?
So you've got the chapagetti, which is a black bean kind of ramen, and then you've got the nyoguri seafood spicy ramen, and you combine it together. But the bougie addition to it is your hanwoo, which is the Korean equivalent of wagyu beef, sirloin that's added on top. So, you know, it's really two fingers up to the proletariats. Wow. Anyway, by the rich people in terms of ramen. So if you feel like you want to have a bit of a luxurious treat this weekend, it's on the Parasite website. But also if you were just to like Google it.
There's so many videos on YouTube. Have you made it and tried it?
Of course I have.
And how did it taste?
It tasted luxurious.
Yeah? Yeah, it's funny. I'm not hugely into Korean food. But I have to say, whenever I watch the movies, if you watch a Hollywood movie and it's food, you can see them just pushing it around the plate for hours. But with the Korean food, especially because it gets very cold in Korea and they have that steam coming.
It's the soft power of Korean cinema
and it makes me
want K-drama.
Food.
Exactly.
And I'm not even into Korean food.
Well, you know, you might just change your mind with this suggestion.
I have enjoyed it. Okay, so...
You're getting a bit hungry in that.
So the suggestion is...
Chapaguri or Chagapuri. I don't know. Ramdon.
YouTube Ramdon.
Yes.
Okay, which is...
From Parasite.
Luke's ramen.
Yes.
Right, okay.
Yes.
And so, Ezra Zide.
What's
your recommendation?
Can you try not to cry?
Calm down now. Calm down. The recommendation is just a book I'm reading right now.
Okay.
It's called, what is it called? Yes, it's called Originals, How Nonconformists Move the World. It's by Adam Grant. It's a really fun, interesting book about how just, you know, when we think about innovators taking risks, it sort of tries to deconstruct a little bit about how genius happens. Like, we know the stories of you know, that particular moment with Edison or Beethoven's great piece of music, but we don't sort of hear about the times that they didn't sort of quite get it right. So moments of greatness almost coincide with how prolific you are, and it doesn't necessarily coincide with these narratives of, oh, you got to go big and take big risks. Some of them know how to manage their risks. So Adam Grant is one of those guys who gets rated as the best professor at Wharton, and he's just a really sort of engaging guy. There's a lot of podcasts about him, but this book is really, really fun and interesting because it tries to make you understand that greatness doesn't come just out of the vacuum. It comes from hard work and assessment and, you know, analysis, and it's quite interesting.
And it's probably also coming from saying goodbye to certain things.
Wow. Thanks for wrapping that up really quite nicely.
Nicely done. So that's for all the kids out there.
Yes, Adam Grant. Originals.
You know, words of wisdom from the man who soon used to be Ezra Zide. And, well, Ezra, you know, good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being on the show.
Yes, and thank you for having me. And as much of this as a goodbye, it's also a see you later.
Yes. And Azura, thank you for being on the show.
Annyeong.
Wonderful. Wonderful. The diversity of this show.
Oh, my God. Do you embarrass your kids?
I probably already do. But you still think I'm cool. So, you know, really? I'm okay for now.
They're like listening to, I don't know, like...
BTS.
They are BTS, are they?
Yeah.
What are they called?
You need to get on board, okay, old man?
What?
No, can we discuss this over Ramdon later?
Okay. And myself, Cam Rastlan, and we're going to play out now with a song chosen by Ezra Zide. It is Don McLean's American Pie, which was apparently about the about Buddy Holly.
Buddy Holly.
And
Buddy
the
Holly
end of an era and a generation.
And that's right. And, what can I say? Good luck to you, Ezra Zide.
Thank you, sir.
And also good luck to all of us in Malaysia.
Absolutely. We need to figure out how to get across the line on this thing.
Yeah.
Gosh.
And
there's some vacancies at Putrajaya here.
And thank you for joining us here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile. And I knew if I had my chance.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.